Hello, I'm Eddie Merckx. Welcome to the VeloCast.
Everyone, and welcome once again to another edition of the VeloCast. My name is Scott.
And I'm John.
Well, I think it's fair to say we're in that post-tour, pre-Vuelta, pre-Eurobike hole that we kind of suffer from just about every year.
It's the Giro's fault, actually, because it started a period of, you know, 2 months of virtual continuous stimulation that's left me exhausted after the tour.
No, I think you're right. I think the Giro being so exciting and The tour being exactly the same is too much for your head to cope with. You just need a wee rest.
I mean, when I was young, I used to have the stamina, and you know, if you'd had the West Lothian Clarion 10-mile Wednesday night time trial on, I would have watched it in Eurosport. But I'll be frank, dear listeners, I've struggled a bit to get excited about some really historic and good races that have happened in the last couple of weeks. But
yeah, so much so that I've had to tear you away from an Oor Willie comic.
You and Lindsay posted that. It mentions Big Al from Wheelworks in the Campsies, who's a legend among cyclists, but is now a cultural icon in Scotland because he's appeared in a DC Thompson cartoon. Brilliant stuff.
Well, if those from more exotic and foreign climes don't know what Oor Willie is, just Google it. It was part of us growing up, really, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Oor Willie and the Bruins. Brilliant stuff.
Yes. Well, coming up on this week's show, Rico on the comeback trail, the not-so-famous five, a secret UN conspiracy, and a bike that is as expensive as it is ridiculous. But first, Saxo Bank's Jakob Fuglsang made it 3 in a row at the Tour of Denmark last Sunday, while Hayden Rolston from HTC Columbia took the final stage into Rudersdal.
Which you flagged up the most ridiculous DS's quote I've ever heard in my life. His DS said he had diamonds in his legs or something.
Sport director Brian Holmes said Hayden rode like he had diamonds in his legs today. He was amazing when he went up the final 800 metres straight. What on earth does he has diamonds in his legs mean?
Maybe it's the same as cocaine up your arse or something. You know, do you remember Lance said to Landis in that stage where in the end, I think it was 2004 maybe, might have been 2005.
At some point in the last decade,
he said, you know, ride it like you stole it. Maybe it means like that, ride it like you're a diamond smuggler. But it makes no sense at all, that quote. But no. Fuglsang, with some great support, notably from Matty Breschel, you can't argue with 3 in a row. I mean, that's a good result in a respected tour. So,
yeah.
Good show.
No, definitely. Matty himself finished second in the final stage, which was 185k, with Manuel Belletti from Colnago CSF finishing third. But in the overall, we were laughing just before we started because we have... Well, do you want to say this? In second and third place?
Well, you've got Tuft and then Bush. Which regular listener to the VeloCast will know that, frankly, we're juvenile at the age of 47, I should know better. But you just can't in the top three have that without it bringing a smile to your face.
Well, the thing was, I never noticed. I was talking about who finished first, second, and third. I never even noticed it was you that pointed out it was Sven Tuft from Garmin Transitions and Matthew Bush from Team Radio Shack. Brilliant.
It's unfortunate.
It was. You also wanted to highlight the ridiculous nature of Podium Girls' clothing.
Well, I think it was either the sprint jersey or the best young riders jersey. But essentially, they make the polka dot jersey during the tour, or the polka dot jerseys, Podium Girls in the Tour de France, look like the most, you know, classic Chanel little black dress. They look like a cross between a munchkin from The Wizard of Oz and a raspberry ripple ice cream. You've just got to see the pictures. I mean, God, I hope those lassies got paid a lot, because they're the most ridiculous bits of clothing I've ever seen in my life.
Well, having said that, I think it was the polka dot jersey or best young rider that I complained about during the tour, saying it looked like Susie Quattro's backing band. They were just ridiculous as well.
It's just stupid.
Yeah, also good to see Mark Renshaw taking a stage win. I think that was in stage four.
Aye, and I mean, he's got that that celebration down pat. If you look at it from a distance, I mean, him and his lead out man essentially look like a carbon copy of Cav and him, you know, with the matching arms raised. They must practice that in the mirror before they race. And Matt Goss, I think, won stage one, which that's another unfortunate name because it always makes me think of crap, you know, 80s pop
the,
twins.
The Nazi friendly Aryan boy band that was Goss.
Aye, Bross even, aye.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's good riders still holding their form. And a nice race to watch.
Meanwhile, Dan Martin from Garmin Transitions won the Tour of Poland on Saturday. Martin finished 23rd safely in the main field on the final 164-kilometre stage to Krakow, which itself was taken in a bunch sprint by Germany's André Greipel.
Aye, the bag of spanners that is Cav's second best sprinter in his team.
Officially now the world's ugliest man.
Well, no, yes, he really is.
Look it up in Wikipedia, folks, that's what it says.
Tour of Poland. Loads of history, fantastic terrain. I mean, Poland is a country. This tour is a fantastic tourist advert. And Dan Martin, he's had promise, he's performed well all year. And he's getting above himself now because he started talking about the big tours on the back of this. But lovely.
Well, this is his first pro tour victory, is that right?
Yeah, I think
we've
talked about him, but I can't remember ever talking about him winning. And I mean, as with Cadell in the World Champs jersey, this might be the making of him. You know, suddenly I can do it, and it's just what he needs, that mental leap where he can step up in the bigger races. But great tourist advert. Frankly, I was not paying much attention, I'm ashamed to say, so...
It was a good race for Garmin themselves, though, because they took the team classification as well.
Yeah, and talking about the team classification, Cameron Meyer was notable by his performances. And he's another one who stepped up from the track. And I think Paul Sloper actually arranged us an interview with him, which is quite exciting once he's back from the race and recovered a wee bit. So we'll see if that comes off. But it's a race that the riders hold in high regard. It's just that for spectators like us, even though we're getting great coverage with good commentary in Eurosport, we're a bit fatigued by now. You know, we need a mid-season break as well.
Okay, well, it looks likely that Tom Boonen will not race the Vuelta later this month and could miss the Road Cycling World Championships in September too. Reports in the Belgian media say that the Quickstep rider returned to training on Friday for the first time since undergoing knee surgery back in July. And team doctors have said Boonen will not be ready to start the Vuelta, which is only 3 weeks away.
Yeah, I mean, without the Vuelta in his legs, he's not going to have the form he needs for the World Champs.
For the Worlds, yeah, sure.
You know, even though it's not a particularly demanding course. So, I mean, it's a shame. I mean, Big Tom's had a stinker in the second half of the year. It's been a real shame for him.
Yeah, the Quickstep doctor, Ivan Van Mol, said the Vuelta looks unlikely and his participation in the Worlds is problematic. The objective is to progressively increase his workload. Tom can return to competition in the middle of September. The most important thing is that Tom recovers completely and that he can race without pain.
Mind you, allegedly they've got a good replacement lined up.
And that would be?
Ricardo Rico, apparently.
Yes, sticking with Quickstep, and manager Patrick Lefebvre has said that he will meet with his sponsors tomorrow before deciding whether or not to open negotiations with Ricardo Rico, but stated that he could see no reason why his team should not consider signing the controversial Italian.
Because he's an annoying cock, that's why they shouldn't sign him.
He said, I don't see the difference between signing a rider like Ivan Basso and signing Rico. They were both suspended for the same thing. You see, look, this is the thing about cycling. I mean, it often frustrates me that the teams are so beholden to the whims of corporate sponsorship. But as they are, you need to consider that people on those teams are representatives of the sponsor. I mean, rolling billboards, as Les Hatch calls them.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't give Rico a job that involved anything more than him saying, do you want fries with that, quite frankly?
I wouldn't give him that.
No, he's an objectionable, misogynistic tosser.
Whereas Basso, for all his misdemeanours and, you know, added to the fact he has an incredibly hot sister, it's actually
which actually counts for a lot.
No, it really does. He's really personable. He's a great ambassador for his sponsor. Whatever he's done in the past, he's come back, he's smiled that lovely smile, and he's looked great on a bike, and he's delivered. Whereas Rico's come back, talked, as you say, been outright misogynist, in his speech, has behaved like an idiot, and I don't think it's credit to anybody. So that's why you shouldn't sign him. It's nothing to do with the fact that he was sanctioned for the same thing as Basso. It's the fact he's an objectionable oaf.
Apparently, he recently bought out his Flamina contract for €75,000 in order to facilitate a change of team for next year.
Aye. Who else is interested? There's somebody
apparently
else interested.
Apparently, Bakal Salai have made moves to say that they're interested in taking him doesn't materialise.
We supported them for a place in the tour because of their strong performances this year. If he goes there, they're in my bad books and off my Christmas card list.
Lefebvre was reluctant to be drawn on rumours that Rico would start the Vuelta for Quickstep should he ultimately reach an agreement with the squad. He also said regarding that possibility, it says if it could be a possibility, but it's all just hypothesis for now. Too many managers are leaking details to the media before they are confirmed. I will speak to my sponsor first. Hang on a minute, Roger, you're speaking to cyclingnews.com here about this. I mean, if this isn't leaking to the media, I really don't know what is. Also, the fact that it actually gets my goat here is that he says, you know, he feels he needs to speak to his sponsor before even agreeing to open negotiations with Rico's agent. Surely that should tell you something.
It's that classic thing. You should be able to say, I'm sorry, no comment, until you've talked to your sponsor in open negotiations. You know.
Just going back to Tom Boonen for a minute there. I mean, as you said, that it's not been the greatest of seasons for him. He's 30 this year. How much time do you think he has left?
Oh, God, I mean, you look at these Belgians, they go on until they draw their pension. I mean, certainly in the single-day classics, I could see him having another good 6 or 7 years. I mean, people like Roger de Vlaeminck and Merckx himself. For a rider in the punchy Northern classics, there's no sell-by date. He's got 6 or 7 years of good career left in him yet.
The only reason I ask is, I think, you know, week in, week out, we say that the sport has changed so much in the last decade, 15 years, whatever, that I was wondering whether the pace of the race and the type of racing now enables you to go on as a sprinter for that length of time anymore.
I think in the races where Boonen's a specialist, yeah, they do. The one place I feel closest to, you know, the classic footage of the 50s, 60s and 70s of cycling is in the Northern Classics where Boonen excels, you know, over the cobbles. You know, we talked about how when Cadell won in the Strade Bianche and wiped the rainbow stripes clean, that, you know, in a black and white print would look like something from 1942. And you still get moments in Flanders and moments in Roubaix where, you know, if you took a black and white filter and put it in front of the camera, it could be Merckx or de Vlaeminck or Godefroot or, you know. It's an area of the sport where the terrain dictates the kind of man that's needed to win, and Tom Boonen, he personifies that kind of man. He's like the ideal model for the Northern Classics.
Moving on now, the Wall Street Journal reported during the week that 5 riders who showed suspect values in tests carried out as part of the UCI's biological passport programme have not yet been sanctioned.
The Wall Street Journal seem to have a bit of crusade going on here.
They do have a bit of a bee in their bonnet regarding doping and cycling, don't they?
Yeah, because it sells papers. I mean, let's be blunt, they were the first of the kind of respected journals to break the Landis case. And, you know, they're not letting it go. They're like a wee terrier with a rabbit in its teeth or something. And they're right. You know, these guys, they went before the independent committee, were flagged as people who were likely dopers, and we've heard nothing. We should have heard something.
Yeah, according to the newspaper, the independent 9-person biological passport committee highlighted 8 blood profiles that it regarded as suspicious and brought them to the attention of the UCI last December. Now, 3 of those riders, Franco Pellizotti, Tadja Valjevic and Jesus Rosendo Prado, were named back in May, but the other 5 riders remain anonymous and unsanctioned.
Yeah, and Pellizotti was sanctioned. I mean, he missed the biggest race of the year for him. So why is nothing else why has nothing happened with the other 5?
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal also claims that at least 2 members of the biological passport panel are concerned that the UCI may be shielding guilty riders from punishment. Now, I think the important thing here would have been, or has been, for the UCI to say, look, these maybe were borderline cases and the investigation is still open. That's why they're still anonymous. That's why nothing's been done yet. Just to clear up any insinuation of shielding from sanction. That, as I say, that the cases weren't as cut and dried and they want to keep investigating.
Yeah, but what they've done is invoked secrecy laws or confidentiality laws, and they're just stonewalling and saying, you know, we don't think there's anything wrong, which is something we see, let's face it, on a virtually weekly basis from the UCI. I don't want to rant about the UCI. There's something else coming up which I think shows them in a bad light, and we'll talk about that. But for God's sake, clear this up. Uncertainty about the results of, you know, tests or, you know, questionable things that go before independent committees needs to be tamped out. We need clarity in the sport, we need due process, and we need visible due process. And once again, we're being denied that.
Yeah, and I also think that the UCI should hand over the data it has to WADA and let them know exactly what the situation with these cases is.
Well, WADA themselves are starting to kind of rattle a sabre a bit. So I think we're going to see some kind of fight for jurisdiction over doping, because WADA themselves are openly saying now they don't think the UCI are, you know, are following procedures properly. So that kind of talk's ramped up a wee bit. So, you know, we'll see what happens.
Well, sticking with borderline cases, it would seem the German press agency SID has reported that former Gerolsteiner team manager Hans-Michael Holzer has claimed that Levi Leipheimer's blood values during the 2005 Tour de France showed a very high probability of manipulation.
Tell you what really pisses me off about this, actually, is nothing to do with Leipheimer's blood values. You know, Leipheimer is either doping or he's not. There's no tests that show him positive just now, so let's do the benefit of the doubt thing. What gets me, though, is that rather than go, his blood values are a bit suspect, let's target him and bring him down. You know, and show that we're really strong in the fight against doping. What we'll do is have a wee word with his manager and make him go away so it doesn't damage the sport. It's that, you know, who guards the Guardians thing again. The UCI have got two hats on. There's a fundamental conflict. The promotion of the sport has to be removed from the same body which is responsible for anti-doping. And this is a perfect example of that.
Yeah. Gerolsteiner's former manager claimed that the UCI informed him on the first rest day of the 2005 Tour de France in Grenoble that Leipheimer's blood values had an off-score coefficient of 132.8. Now, that's just 0.2 under the limit of 133. Our normal score is 85 to 95, and scores over 133 can be considered evidence of doping. He said, it was clear to me that Levi had manipulated.
Now, I've had discussions with people where they've said, oh, this is just, you know, one more man speaking out, you know, and there's no corroboration. But all of these people are coming out the woodwork. I mean, individually, you may be able to discount them. And I'm not going to speak about individual cases like Leipheimer here, but the fact that there are now so many people coming out and speaking, and it's, you know, it's that trickle, that Chinese water torture. Every week, somebody new comes out and says, aye, we did it. I think Associated Press were reporting that Armstrong, for example, has just been officially named as a person of interest in the Nowitzki investigation, and that two of his former teammates have come forward and have spoken to, you know, to the grand jury. So, you know, it's a lot of smoke. Maybe there is no fire, maybe there isn't, but this is moving faster than I expected it to, and Holzer speaking out is just another example of people coming out the woodwork.
I mean, full disclosure here, you could level a charge of saying, well, the guy's got a book to sell, which is, he was at the book launch when this interview was conducted. And, you know, this kind of controversy with a very, very well-known rider does sell books.
No, I completely agree with that. And that's why I'm saying he is just one person. But there's a weight of numbers now that's coming to bear. And they don't all have a book to sell or an axe to grind. So, I think we could see some resolution to this as early as late next year, which is, to be honest, about 2 years quicker than I thought. So, mm-hmm. I mean, this space?
Yeah, the kind of the mire here is based on Gerolsteiner's problems at the time with the contract, or sorry, the clause in their contract that said the sponsor would immediately remove itself from the team if they had two riders done for doping in one season. And they already had one at that point, and if Levi had gone, that really would have been the end of the team. I mean, yeah, it transpired that happened a couple of years later, of course, but at that point, they were facing financial ruin.
But to be blunt, I mean, that just highlights what I'm talking about with the UCI. They shouldn't, if you're a proper independent anti-doping council, following procedure properly, the fact a team will go under shouldn't matter a toss to you. You know, you're you should just prosecute the bloody thing until it's finished. You shouldn't be saying, he looks a bit dodgy, take him out. You should be testing him because his blood value levels show that he's worthy of an enhanced testing protocol.
No, I agree. It's the, you know, try and find another reason to remove him from the race quote that I find really unsettling here. And on this story, there has been no comment from the UCI at all.
We should ask them.
We should.
We can stalk Pat McGuade at Eurobike with a big kind of pocketbook of questions.
I won't wear a Velocast jersey of any description, though. Try and sneak up on him unawares. Okay, the Trek Bicycle Corporation has confirmed to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that they have provided documents to a federal criminal investigation involving Lance Armstrong. Trek spokesman Bill Mashick told the newspaper that company officials were contacted by investigators just before last month's start of the Tour de France.
That's actually one way which I think the press, and I'm talking about proper press, not podcasters like us, have slightly corrupted this story, is that because Lance is so high profile, the entire investigation's hung off his name in the press. And that, you know, that gives the impression that it's actually an investigation that's purely out to get Lance Armstrong. It's not. It's to involve, you know, it's to investigate wholesale doping accusations. It's not targeted at one man who may well end up as being collateral damage to that investigation or may end up being entirely exonerated. I mean, time will tell and we'll let it run its course. But the reason we want to talk about this is for once the Velocast were actually right.
Because we mean said for once? How dare you, sir, for
well,
once?
Well, we're almost always wrong. But this, with this one, we said that Trek's notable absence of any meaningful comment meant they'd probably already been contacted. And they have, and, you know, it's a reputable company. They've supported the investigation, as they should have. And now they've come out and confirmed that. So, move on.
Yeah, I mean, this, of course, is into the alleged selling of bikes on eBay to fund the doping program. I mean, it surprises me that we haven't heard eBay themselves being subpoenaed to hand over transaction details yet.
Sold a bike on eBay, and it's to fund doping.
Really? Well, at least you're honest about it.
Yeah, it's to fund
full disclosure.
Mostly Belgian or German beer doping when we're away at Eurobike.
Now, Italian shoemaker Geox has switched its sponsorship commitment back to Futon Servetto for 2011, while French sponsor Bouygues Telecom, see I got it right that time, is to continue its backing for at least one more season of the French cycling team.
Yeah, well done, Bouygues. I mean, they've got some great advertising out, the likes of, you know, Tommy Vaucler and the like. Geox, Futon, please redesign your strip. Particularly if you've got Damiano Carrigo going, you know, can you imagine the little prince in that shite brown outfit that they had to wear this year? I mean, it's just wrong.
I mean, I suppose this is a terrible, terrible strip aside, a good news story in that, of course, this is the remnants of the old Sonia Duval team, and it is good to see them coming through the Rico and Peopley scandals of...
Yeah, and I mean, we've seen some great performances from them this year, and they certainly stand out in that strip. So from a marketing point of view, maybe it's a success. But Canego, you know, those iconic Lamprey colours, to see him end his career in something that looks like, you know...
Someone's vomited over it.
An accident in a Roman first century laundry. It would just be wrong.
Of course, Geox were a secondary sponsor at Lamprey. Do you see this affecting Lamprey at all?
No.
Well, that was succinct. And according to the Keep newspaper, Beebox, Bouygues Telecom are set to renew their sponsorship of Jean-René Bernardot's cycling team for another season. Now, in an echo of last season, it appears that the squad has managed to secure its future thanks to some publicity-grabbing performances at this year's Tour de France.
Well, that's what they're paying for. You know, it's the billboard, particularly for the French companies. You show up in the Tour, you're on every French television programme that covers the Tour. You're selling to their market. So it's a sensible investment, besides being, you know, emotionally quite satisfying to see a team stick by for another year.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Thomas Vaucler, but we also had Pierrick Federico also winning a stage, and Anthony Chateau took the King of the Mountains.
Aye, I mean, brave performances all, and loads of telly time.
Yeah, and apparently they've also got La Banque Postale touted as being a co-sponsor for next season before becoming the main sponsor the following year. So it looks like there's a future in that team.
French cycling, I mean, is going to go from strength to strength in the back of this year's tour, because even though they don't have anyone who can win, they've got lots of riders who've shown they can, you know, they can take a day, and that they can do their home nation proud in a tour where, frankly, they've been virtually invisible for far too long. So I think we could even see Bouygues extend for further, and I think we'll maybe see some other French sponsors stepping up to the plate.
Yes, now, in an interview released by his agent this week, Alberto Contador said he's raising the bar with his move to Saxo Bank SunGard in 2011, with likely participation in two Grand Tours next season.
Well, that's known territory for him. I mean, he's won the Giro and the Vuelta, so he's done the double before. He's hedging his bets slightly on Reese's he can win all three in 1 year.
Well, it did strike me last week that all this talk, and it was rattling around Twitter and cycling forums the world over, about Contador's claim he was going to do three Grand Tours in 1 year. And I thought, hang on a minute, no, Bert himself had never said that. It was something that Reese said.
Yeah, exactly. The thing that got me, he was saying he allegedly turned down €5 million. From the Kazakhs, you know, they offered them that to stay.
Yeah.
And we were talking about how Saxo Bank's entire contribution for the year was €6 million. So either Bert's made a sporting decision to go to the team that he believes will support him best, and he's taken a pay cut over what the Kazakhs offered him, or SunGard have really, you know, dug deep into their pockets and looked down the back of the sofa.
I mean, I think if that is true, that there was a €5 million deal to stay with Astana and that Contador has turned it down, I still think he was right to do so.
Oh, no argument here.
No, because for me, for the longest time, Astana have always seemed like, I mean, I'm desperately trying to think of an appropriate word, an edgy team. I mean, we go back to probably about this time last year when there was talk of riders' salaries not being paid and, you know, nothing happening with the team, and it looked like it could implode at any minute. And to be honest with you, John, I can see that happening again at some point in the future. And if you're Alberto Contador, that's not what you want.
No, you need stability. And I mean, with the sponsors he's got, and with Reese having a secret sponsor in his back pocket who stepped back to allow Saxo to step forward this year, there's some long-term stability there. And he knows that come the tour, it's not going to be, is Vino going to play fair? You know, is Lance going to attack him? It's going to be all about Contador come the tour, or whatever other, you know, Grand Tour he decides to race if he does two next year. There'll be no decisive or no divisive choice of leaders. It's one man and a team built around him. So I think he's made a very sensible sporting move.
Yeah, and it looks like Astana need to be getting their checkbooks out again to go shopping with Benjamin Noval, Jesus Hernandez and Danny Navarro, looking likely to go with Contador to Saxo Bank.
I think I could see them just refocusing. I mean, they've got Vino, they've got that boy that went over from Lakegas who was 10th in the Giro. They could just refocus and be a classics support team for Vino, because I mean, Vino's had a great year in his comeback, but, you know, however I last spoke of him at the start, he's ridden proudly Liège-Bastogne-Liège, for God's sake, you know. So I mean, that's somebody who deserves a team built around him if you believe in him, and essentially it's his team. So they may just shift their focus away from the Grand Tours, other than for stage wins, and give him and some new classics riders support and become, you know, a Kazakh equivalent of Quickstep or something.
Well, with allegedly $5 million in the coffers waiting to be spent, I think it's kind of strange that we haven't heard any rumours of who Astana are negotiating to tempt away from other teams.
Oh, no,
so maybe
Vino,
you're right there.
I think it's Vino's team now, in every sense of the word, as opposed to just emotionally.
Yeah. Well, soon-to-be ex-Saxo Bank rider Andy Schleck has ridiculed the idea by Bjarne Riis and Alberto Contador that the Spaniard could win three Grand Tours in one season.
Well, he's going to do that, isn't he? I mean, let's be blunt, because if he says, he could do it, essentially he's saying, actually, I'm rubbish, I can't win any of them. So, I mean, that's a bit of a no-brainer for him. As it happens, I agree with him. I think in the modern climate, it would be an awesome performance, which would, as I said last week, need a perfect storm of circumstance and, you know, riders getting injured, supreme form, luck with weather, luck with teams, you know, luck everywhere if he was going to do all three. And trying to do all three might even jeopardise your chance of doing one. So it would be a brave thing. But I kind of agree with Andy. It's not the same as when, you know, Merckx could dominate an entire season, and even he never managed that.
No, absolutely. I, for what it's worth, I agree with you too. Now, following Jerseygate, Chaingate and Lance's final tour, Velo News took the opportunity to speak to Johan Brunel, where the Radio Shack DS also discussed the future.
I thought this was a really interesting interview because it felt very honest to me. In essence, you know, it tracks his feelings and his responses throughout the tour as things developed, you know, talking about Lance's crash. He's quite open about Contador being, you know, the best tour rider in the world, and doesn't discount the fact that he'll equal Lance's record in the Tour de France, which I think is, you know, it's quite open and quite decent of Johan Brunel. And he says essentially he was never that pissed off with Bert. It was the Kazakhs that he split with.
Yeah,
and he chose to go with Radio Shack.
Yeah, that was probably the most interesting bit for me, because I think it was built up last year as being Contador out in the cold and Team Lance electing to go as a consequence because of this rivalry between Armstrong and Contador. So it was interesting and quite heartening to see that, you know, he has nothing against Contador himself.
No, and I mean, he's quite open. He's said Lance isn't going to race the Tour next year. And I mean, I've seen quite a wee groundswell of people who, you know, assuming he's not busy with other stuff, who think he should, just because this year was such a disaster for him, that for a grand champion like him, it's not the way he should leave the race that was essentially his. But I think it's time for him to move on. And Brunel, I mean, he's a student of Machiavelli, I think, so who knows what hidden messages are in this interview. But you should give it a read, because it's open and honest in my eyes. It's a good read.
Okay, just looking at that interview then, what do you kind of think, or how do you feel about Brunel's future and what he should do to kind of preserve that legacy or extend it?
Well, I think it's finished. I mean, I think this is the classic Velocast thing. He'll be signed as the head DS with the Luxembourg team of Frank and Andy Schleck next week. But I think he's so tied to Lance that the end of the Armstrong era is also the end of the Brunel era. I think he was tempted by the Kazakhs and tempted by Contador as a talent. But when Lance made his comeback, we saw where Brunel's heart lies. I doubt very much if he's got to worry about the money coming in for work. I mean, he could probably do what he likes for the rest of his life now.
No, sure. So, I mean, I think really there have been so many heir apparents with Armstrong. It's now very, very difficult for... There doesn't seem to be a plan post-Lance. I totally agree with you, because you think back about all those riders who were touted as being, or were told specifically, as soon as Lance goes, you're the man.
Yeah.
You know,
except there isn't.
And there isn't, yeah.
There's an emotional, and a bond of friendship and trust between them, which I don't think Brunel could replicate that. And to be honest, if you've won 7 tours, what have you got to prove? You know, all you can do is damage your legacy. Move on, do charity work, you know, support the Belgian junior squad or something. I can't see him being a DS of another Tour Contenders team.
Okay, now the Republican candidate in the Colorado primary, Dan Mays, has insinuated that the Denver bike sharing scheme is part of a bizarre UN conspiracy and threatens America's personal freedoms.
I have no idea where to start on this.
Well, okay, where we should start, I think this is so insane that I think it might be worth spending a couple of minutes in the audio company of Mr. Mays as he is interviewed here by MSNBC.
Running for the Republican nomination for governor in Colorado. Good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
You know, you live in a state where there's a lot of environmental consciousness. We keep hearing about we're too dependent on oil, and you have a program that encourages people not just to bike around and not use gas, but also presumably to get a little healthier. What's so bad about that?
Well, the Denver Post article that you might have learned this from took a lot of comments out of context. The bike program in and of itself is fine. I'm a biker. I rode the seat off my mountain bike last year myself. But what we are concerned about is that this is just one piece of a larger UN program titled ICLEI, Communities for Sustainability. And it also includes a lot of other dynamics within city management. And I was trying to draw a distinction between myself and the Democratic mayor of Denver. And so the bicycle program in and of itself is not bad. What I'm concerned about is what's behind it all.
And what's behind it all that has you so upset?
Well, again, we're trying to differentiate myself from the mayor. If I win the primary, and when we win the primary tomorrow, people are going to say, what's the differences? Because we're both business people. And when the mayor signs onto a program that's sponsored by the United Nations, that should bring concern to people as to how that program may or may not be compatible with our state constitution.
Now, the scary thing about that is this interview isn't the whole madness thing. I think he's already realized he sounds like an idiot, and he's backed off a wee bit. But even then, even in this, politically, his entire statement seems to be, I was trying to be a bit different for the other guy. But this Tea Party bunch, I'm literally at a loss for words about them. I tweeted yesterday, is this a spoof? And I got lots of response from Americans as well as UK guys saying, actually, no, the Tea Party are just mental. And so it seems. I mean, Americans, there's much I admire about your country, but this is just nuts.
I love the bit where the interviewer says, what is behind all of this that has you so upset? And he says, well, we're trying to differentiate myself from the mayor. That clears all that up then, doesn't it? You know, shall we all just storm the UN buildings in New York and Geneva right now and massacre those pinko commie pen pushers?
So the UN like Schmersh or something? You know, I'm literally at a loss for what this. I've got a very broad political interest. This is way outside what I consider mainstream politics. This guy's just a whack job. Sorry.
I think the world should adopt a kind of three strikes and you're out rule for potential politicians. You know, say three things as stupid as this, and then you have to carry around a sock full of horse manure that the public can just slap you about the face with whenever it likes.
No, he's mental.
Yes. Anyway, Radio Shack rider Lance Armstrong has pulled out from the Leadville Trail 100, the mammoth mountain biking event that he won last year. The American opted out of the 100-mile-long race, citing the after effects of his difficult Tour de France.
Well, he's saying he's still suffering from the hip injury after that huge crash he had at the roundabout, which we saw the fan video of at the time.
Yeah.
Frankly, the conspiracy theorists are having a field day because it's, you know, he's keeping his profile low because of the investigation that's going on. But make no mistake, if you're feeling a wee bit injured, 100 miles at over a mile high isn't the kind of thing you want to do if you're trying to recover. So, you know, if he's hip sore, that's why he's backed out.
No, I've got no reason to believe that that's not the case. I mean, it makes perfect sense. As you say, it's not exactly a Sunday club run here. It's a serious, serious event.
Yeah, I mean, we've got there's a Scotsman from the West Coast, from your neck of the woods, riding it. And it was funny because I had a wee tweet saying, do you want to do an interview once it's finished and that sort of thing. And he's up for that, but he said, I have to go back to kind of Denver to recover in thicker air. Now, Denver's a mile high, so if that's thicker air, imagine what it feels when you're trying to race in this thing.
Yeah, quite. Going back to Lance, it's said that he has no other races planned for the remainder of 2010. And, I mean, the question there is, do you think we'll ever see Lance in a pro peloton again?
I've no idea. I think we'll see him in a triathlon, if circumstance allows. Because Radio Shack, you know, the contract is that they wanted at least one tour out of him, I think. But other than that, he's committed to multi-sport events. He doesn't need to do it for the money. I think he can do what the hell he wants. We'll see at the start of next year.
Yeah, he spent an entire career around winning the Tour de France, and he said this is his last, so why would he race in anything else now?
Yeah, exactly. But I think if we are going to see him, it'll be in a triathlon or a multi-sport event.
Sure. Right, let's move on to some gear news. And where on earth do I begin with this? According to PG Bikes, the Black Trail is the future of urban transport devices.
Aye, if you're hideously rich and have no sense of style.
This is as insane as the politician we spoke about a moment ago. Really, where do you start with this?
This was sent to me by Distiller on Twitter, producer of really quite surprisingly good English whiskey. But I think you'd have to have drunk a fair bit of his product to think this is a good idea. It's an electric bike, and e-bikes are everywhere. You know, I mean, they're taking over the world. It's got a wheel set, which is 1,600 grams for the wheel set, which when you consider it's got to carry the weight of a motor, for something the set of a, you know, the weight of a set of Mavic Ceriums, that's quite an achievement. It's a full carbon wheel set, and its maximum speed is 100 kilometres an hour, which makes it a pedalled motorbike in my eyes. Cruising speed's 50 kilometres an hour, and you'll get 200 kilometres at the cruising speed. So, you know, all the technical specs are starting to rack up.
Right, I think, let's cut the foreplay.
Okay, it's 60,000 euros.
60,000, and that doesn't include shipping costs.
I'd want it delivered by the pandas we were talking about many episodes ago. And I'd want them to stay overnight. And 60,000 euros.
And it's probably the most hideous thing I've seen in a long, long time as well.
Well, it looks very steampunk. It's that kind of Wild Wild West thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where you could imagine Kenneth Branagh trying to hide his embarrassment at appearing in such an awful film by riding off into the sunset on this. It's mental. I mean, just go and have a look at this. There's nothing about it that doesn't make me raise my eyes and go, what the hell were they smoking when they thought this up?
Yeah, yeah. The drugs don't work, folks. And we'll put a link to this hideously expensive machine in the show notes. Now, Giant Bicycles confirmed its plans to open a $60 million factory in Kushan, China, at its annual retailer meeting known as The Link.
Which shows confidence. They're going to produce composite bikes here. You know, it's not just cheap low-end bikes. They believe in the future. They're investing in the infrastructure to produce bikes. Because the one thing I've heard from a lot of dealers, and Trek were talking about it as well at the Trek World presentation, John Burke was saying that they're reintroducing quite harsh demands for pre-season orders, which is where if you're a dealer, you have to say, I guarantee I'll take these bikes throughout the year, which is a really scary thing to do because you're committing to a huge chunk of money. You know, it's far more comfortable to assume bikes will be in stock and just order them as you need them. But what Giant and Trek found this year was, for example, one of the Madones, popular Madone, was sold out by March. You know, so they missed out the entire tour period. Giant had run out of entire ranges by the middle of the year. And this is talking to local retailers around me in Scotland. This isn't just kind of reading this off. People just couldn't get the bikes they needed. So Trek are trying to pre-order with dealers, which will give them some more kind of headway for planning so they can get better supply. And Giant are going, we'll just build another factory. So it shows that there's strength in the trade, and it's no time for doom and gloom. Folk are believing in the future and putting their money where their mouth is.
Yeah, and the most surprising element of this was that they say the factory will be up and running by May 2011.
Well, you know, it's the Chinese. They've got people to throw at it. I didn't mean that in a kind of pejorative sense. You know, the
well,
economy.
It came across that way.
I know. It's the Chinese. What I meant is the economy is growing so fast. I mean, people that... you talk about people going to big Chinese cities like Shanghai, and in 2 years, the entire feel of the place and the actual kind of structural underpinning of the place has changed because it's growing so fast. And, you know, they're Chinese. What I meant is they're growing so fast, they will throw money, labour and effort into it and get up and running fast because it stokes the fire of their economy. And Giant are taking advantage of that, and we'll see more bikes available as a result. So, brave move. Good.
I actually knew what you meant. I just wanted to let you dig yourself out that hole there. Now, it looks certain that next month's Eurobike trade show will be swamped with e-bikes as a host of manufacturers are getting ready to release their own versions into the marketplace.
Oh, great.
I noticed Carlton Reid, who puts together the Daily Show magazine that you get at Eurobike, amongst many other things. I'm not saying that's the only thing that Carlton does. He was complaining that all the pre-release stuff from Eurobike was on e-bikes, and actually suggested they should just rename the whole bloody show that.
E-bike, well, it's what we call it anyway. Mm. I hope to God they're more exciting than they were in the Zeppelin Hall last year. I'm coming home after a day.
I think that's precisely what we said last year, that it's going to need to have the mainstream manufacturers wholly embrace e-bike technology and releasing e-bikes to make a difference. Because as you say, going into the Zeppelin Hall, where it was very separate, it was a definite different feel across there from the rest of the show.
And it felt like you were going to a craft fair.
It was as dull as dishwater, it really was.
I tell you, the big guys are coming to play though now. I mean, Scott have got an e-bike which uses Shimano's 11-speed Alpine hub that we've talked about.
Yep.
Trek is coming in with its sales, what is it, the 50,000 e-bikes in 2009 from Trek?
Yeah, which, I mean, they really kind of jumped on it last year.
But you've got Cannondale. I mean, everybody's coming on board with e-bikes. And I mean, we've been saying it was something whose time was coming once they got them attractive. What these big guys come with is a design shop in-house, which means it doesn't look like it's cobbled together by, you know, your local mechanic in a blacksmith shed. It actually looks like a design bike, and this is the breakthrough that was needed. So please God make them look nice, and please God don't put them in a dingy hall. But I'm actually quite excited to see how they've moved on in a year, because e-bikes were big last year at Eurobike. They're going to be enormous this year, and I'm looking forward to seeing the change in the market.
Yeah, noticeable by their kind of absence here are Specialized as one of the big three. They were obviously presenting.
Well, they can't. They've got to keep their motor technology secret.
That's what it is. Well, I was going to say they presented the 2011 product lineup to the press and dealers back in June, and I don't think there was any e-bikes in their lineup. I can't see that being the case for very long, though. You know, as Cannondale and Giant and Trek are all presenting e-bikes, suddenly Specialized are left with no e-bikes on their stand.
Yeah, and it's strange because Specialized have got a really strong urban sector. You know, the urban bit of their range is every bit as exciting as the other manufacturers. So it's a notable omission. Who knows, we might go there and there'll be a grand unveiling if we remember our business cards this time.
Yes, let's not make that mistake again. debuting at the aforementioned Trek World this year, Gary Fisher, under the newly named Gary Fisher Collection moniker, has been showing off his new Kronos cross-country bike.
Which is horny as a horny thing's horny bits. I kind of want one of these. I've come to the conclusion that the whole Fisher Collection thing with Trek, it's not actually damaging the product that we see from Fisher. You know, I think there was some truth in Gary's talk about how it gives him access to people who weren't available to work on his line last year because they were integrated into the main Trek design company. I still feel sorry for the dealers who were specific Fisher dealers. And I mean, that's something I really do disagree with. But this cyclocross bike, full carbon, I mean, just look at it, seriously. It takes a lot of the shaping that they've developed through the development of the Madones, for example, in the Trek line. Shorty ultimate brakes, which are beautiful cantilever brakes. Front hub's got an oversized axle, which will, you know, stiffen up the front end. It's just lovely.
I'm glad you mentioned the Madone, because my only problem with this is Fisher stuff is starting to look very Trek-like. And all the design cues are saying Trek to me now. They're not saying Fisher. And I'm not saying that Trek design cues are inherently bad. I mean, the Madone's a beautiful bike. It's just there's no individual Gary Fisherness about them.
Well,
that's the only thing. I mean, as you say, that's a cracking looking bike, and I would have it in a heartbeat.
You don't want to look at the picture of the underside of the down tube then.
Why?
It says Trek in big letters.
What does it? Is that what because you can kind of see it.
No, it says Trek in huge letters.
You can kind of see it from the side shots. There's just this kind of rectangles appearing, and obviously, as you say, it's all written on the underside of the down tube, and that's what you can see from the side pictures.
And it's what you'll see when somebody picks up the bike to carry it in a pro cyclocross race.
Yes.
I still think 2 or 3 years from now, I mean, I don't think the product's damaged this year. I think there's still a lot of input. 2 or 3 years from now, Gary Fisher will be another Keith Bontrager. You know, talented guy who's paid a consultant's fee and a licensing fee, but we'll see the really quirky stuff that I loved about Fisher bikes gradually disappear as the Trek fleet becomes, you know, more homogenous. And that's not to say they're not fantastic bikes. I love Treks. I mean, I wandered around 5 bike shops today because, you know, I was selling one of my bikes for doping, so I needed a box, and I didn't have a frame box to hand to ship it. And I had to go around all 5 local shops to get one. Because, and this is for somebody who... I'm off at a tangent here, but for folk who go in and ask for bike boxes to ship things, they're really bulky, so shops can't afford to have them kicking about. You know, shops aren't being nasty by saying they don't have them. But Alpine Sports, which is our local Trek shop, I was just gobsmacked by the look of this year's Treks. They're beautiful, beautiful bikes. But I'm going to miss it if Fisher's just a name on the down tube next year or the year after, and it's not actually Gary's stuff.
Yes, now, every now and again we feature something from the Velo Orange blog, and the products there never fail to disappoint. And so it is again with a couple of things from Orange, including the VO triple crank and the wide range polyvalent crank.
I've got nought to say about this, just go and look at them. They're incredibly shiny, and I would just put them in the corner and stare at them. The triple crank, it's going to come in at 125 with 48, 36, 28 rings, which is really sensible for a road triple that's not for racing or fast sportives. It's just gorgeous. It comes with proper machined alloy dust caps instead of the crappy plastic things that break. The polyvalent crank I'm really excited about because it's 4630, which with, for example, a wide range 10-speed cassette will give you roughly the equivalent range to a triple, you know, with a normal road cassette. But it's got a built-in chain guard to keep your trousers clean. So for an urban bike, that would be a great basis to start a build. And there's the classic one based in the old TA crank as well. Chris, the owner of Velo Orange, is, for old farts like me, he's just producing gold every time he puts, you know, pen to paper to design a part.
Yes, the triple is $125 and the polyvalent is $105. So not exactly expensive either.
No, I mean, great value, beautiful things. If you want something that's a bit out of the ordinary to build a bike that isn't a pure race bike, go and have a look at Velo Orange. Their stuff's brilliant. I mean, I got a wee headset or a wee clamp headset spacer for my bell, which was a pick in an early Velocast, you know, the brass Japanese bell that makes you go deaf. And it's just... it's a perfectly designed little part that solves a problem. That seems to me what Velo Orange are all about. And these crank sets fill a niche. He's never going to sell a shed load of them, but I'll certainly have one.
And you can find out more at velo-orange.blogspot.com. On now to the new Le Monde fitness product, which is called the Revolution. And it's a wind resistance trainer and is said to provide more realistic resistance than fluid or magnetic trainers.
And it probably will. I mean, the big problem with wind trainers is the noise. I mean, you know, when you're turbo training and you've got the fan on, because you need a fan when you're turbo training to keep you cool, because you don't have the airflow going over you because you're moving forward.
Mm.
You know the racket that makes. Some of these wind trainers make a bloody racket. I mean, it sounds like a 737 taking off in your house. But they do provide, if they're well designed, very good feel compared to, you know, compared particularly to some of the cheaper magnetic ones. What I like about this is, you know, turbo trainers trash back tyres and, you know, put a lot of stress in wheels and that sort of thing. With this one, you actually take your back wheel off and there's a cassette on the thing, which is part of the drive for the trainer.
Yeah.
So all you do is just whip your back wheel on, you know, pop it straight on the trainer. It's stable. It feels good. It's a well-designed, nice trainer. I like it.
Yeah, and it accepts Shimano or SRAM 9 or 10-speed cassettes, and apparently they've got a Campy adapter available too.
Yeah.
No details on price yet, but you can find out more info at www.lemondfitness.com. Well, finally then, spotted at the Urban Velo website is the new Felt TK4130.
Catchy name.
Oh, fair trips off the tongue.
I think it's because it's made of chrome alloy steel. 4130 is the most popular chrome alloy steel for making bike frames.
That's what it is.
The 30, by the way, is the carbon content of the steel. So the entire 41 series are chrome alloy, but the numbers at the end tell you the carbon content. There you go. Educational as well as interesting.
Well, I'll go with the first one. Not so much the latter, but there you go.
They use 4150 for making gun barrels.
Right, now you're just getting scary. Can we get back to the bike before?
Shall we talk about the bike?
Might be an idea.
$800. It's what we've talked about. You're kind of hipster fixie. The things I like about this is that the fork crown is, they talk about double play crown. It's a stylish old, it looks like a classic old track fork crown. It's got false wooden rims, which is brilliant. I just love it. The other thing that's really stylish, to highlight the fact that it's a steel frame, instead of painting the whole thing, they've left the fork ends and the at the front and the rear unpainted and clear-coated them so that you can see the braze marks. It's just, it's a stylish, reasonably inexpensive steel fixed wheel bicycle that, you know, wouldn't look out of place hanging in any garage or out in the road. I just like it. And Felt are doing great stuff just now. They're doing really good, incredibly expensive time trial bikes, and they're doing really good cheap steel bikes. So it's a brand I'd be happy stocking.
Definitely, and at $800, it's not too expensive, as you say, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. Now, I think it's probably time for some picks of the week.
I'm very excited about mine this week.
I know you are, as you've talked at length, if not ad nauseam, about it. So do you want to go first, or shall I?
But you go first, because mine's going to be far better than yours, so we might as well get the rubbish out of the way first.
Well, we've talked a lot about the importance of being seen at night here at the Velocast, and we've also mentioned quite a few solutions for making your wheels more visible. So my pick of the week is the Cyglo from Nightbright. Now, this is a system where the LEDs are actually built into the tread and can either flash or be on permanently, so when the wheel turns at any speed, a perfect ring of light is formed whilst continually and perpetually creating its own power.
Actually, I've seen this, it's quite cool.
It is, and the only reason this is my pick of the week is that ever since I saw Tron when I was a kid, I always wanted one of the light cycles.
So you hated Tron?
Oh, no. We will fight.
My kids are really excited about the Neutron thing that
Tron
Legacy, be doing with the first one. Huh?
That's why it's my pick of the week, because it basically just turns your bike into something from that looks like it was from Tron, and for no other reason than that.
Get a pair of Halo rims, and suddenly nobody's got an excuse for not seeing you. I saw these in the Bicycle Design, you know, James's site.
Yep.
The only thing he raised was the durability of the LEDs he was unsure of, and something that's so exposed to the elements and to the ground. And I think there were also some questions being raised about recycling. But to be blunt, I must stop saying that. It's become the new all joking aside. Right, I'm stopping saying both of them. Honestly, this is something that was going to get you seen. So those are minor points that you could put aside. I like these. They're brilliant.
Yeah, they're not for sale as yet, so obviously we have no details on price, but you can register your interest at nightbrighttire.com. Now that we've got, in your words, the rubbish out of the way, let's get to your pick of the week.
Wasn't rubbish, actually. It was quite good.
Not patronising at all. Get on with it.
It's the festival in Edinburgh just now, which people from around the world get very excited about, but frankly, as someone who was born and bred in Edinburgh, I usually hide in the cupboard until it's finished, because what it means is the town is full of nutters and mental people who insist on trying to hand you bits of paper when you're just trying to walk down the street. However, my middle lad, the one who's not interested in cycling, is slightly less cynical about things than me, so he was really excited about going to something on the fringe. And I said to him, you know, pick anything you want. We'll go and see whatever you want to see. We'll have a day in the town and we'll do a fringe day. And he picked a play called Pedal Pusher, which is about cycling. And I'm pretty sure he picked it because he didn't really care what he wanted to see, you know. He just wanted a feeling for the fringe because he's 16. He likes the atmosphere of theatre and that sort of thing. And we went to see it. And it was absolutely brilliant. Starts in 1997 with Ulrich Furst winning the tour, and closes in 2004 with the death of Marco Pantani. And it tracks the careers of Pantani, Ulrich and Lance Armstrong through those years, with the aid of a couple of boxes, some really well done music, four crash barriers and four plastic chairs. And it's, they reenact key moments of stages. They reenact key interviews where they were lifting whole quotes, which I could remember the interview they were part of. I've never, ever enjoyed a piece of media about cycling as much as I enjoyed this play. Not even the classic films like Stars and Water Carriers and that sort of thing. It just, bits of it had me in tears, bits of it had me laughing. And the best ad I can give it is my son, who has no interest in cycling, came away from it and is now reading Matt Rundell's Death of Marco Pantani.
I mean, I know it might sound strange being a pick of the week for something on a show that gets, you know, downloaded right across the world, but get in touch with a theatre company if you want to bring it somewhere closer to you, and I'm sure.
Well, they've already done 4 weeks in London. Mm-hmm. I mean, so it wasn't your classic, you know, thrown together in a backroom fringe production.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, it's a properly staged bit of theatre. So, I mean, I'll go and see other stuff from this company as well. But for a cyclist, I mean, the place was full of bloody cyclists. I was trying not to talk loud in case somebody recognised me. But there were lots of ordinary members of the public. And the List magazine, which is, you know, the Bible, if you like, for theatre and entertainment in Edinburgh, certainly during the Fringe, has named it as one of the 20 must-see events of the Fringe. So it's not just me, and it's not just the fact it was about cycling and about cyclists who, you know, are part of my life because I was growing up when they were performing. It's a piece of general theatre that has got non-cyclists excited as well. I loved it.
Yes, now I think that's probably all we have time for this week. Thank you for listening and staying subscribed. You can contact us at our website, velocast.co.uk, or on Twitter, where we are at Velocast. Well, we hope you all have a great week and hope to speak to you again soon for another edition of the Velocast.